62 years ago, something fell out of the sky outside of Roswell, New Mexico. We're not exactly sure, positive anyway, what it was. The reason we suspect it was a flying saucer is because that's what the military told us it was, using that exact term. I had a chance to meet Don Schmidt last year at a conference here in Las Vegas. We did an interview, and I just knew at the time that that you would enjoy him as a guest. He is the former co-director of the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies, where he was director of special investigations for 10 years. Prior to that, he worked with the late Dr. J. Allen Hynek, and he is one of the recognized world's authority on the Roswell case. Don, thanks for being with us. Are you there?
Yes. Morning, George.
Hey, good morning. You know, when I first introduced the program tonight, I raised the question of, you know, how is it possible that after all this time, all the scrutiny that this case has received, that it is even possible for new information still to come out?
Well, I think it's mainly due to our dogged determination that we're still going to try to track down every surviving witness. As even Stan Friedman puts it, we've run this race with the Undertaker, that as long as there's still time to provide these people with an opportunity to go on the record and tell us the truth as to what actually did indeed crash back in July of 1947, we're going to be knocking on their doors. And I think, as demonstrated by past efforts, that we are becoming all the more aggressive in that approach.
And approaching it sort of like a cold case, like a criminal investigator would approach a cold case.
The ultimate cold case file, as we describe it, because and we approach it as though we're investigating a crime, minus it being a crime, though that's something that still may be debatable down the road. In fact, it's one of the reasons we believe is the very reason for the cover-up after all these years, the culpability by the United States government, the fact that they did indeed threaten and use the military to threaten and possibly carry out some of those threats, American citizens. Whoever would be responsible after all this time certainly would have hell to pay regarding the fact that after now 62 years, as you describe it, they are now up to four official explanations, and the fact that the weather balloons, more specifically the Mogul balloon, still remains the official explanation. And I defy any skeptic to demonstrate why people would be threatened, even up to today, over something as mundane, something as ridiculously simple as a rubber weather balloon.
Well, they do seem to have a trouble making up their minds. It was a weather balloon, then it was a extra special weather balloon, then it was a super-duper secret weather balloon, and there were crash test dummies, and the story continues to change, and I think the military has sort of painted itself into a corner.
They certainly have, and as the spokesperson at the Pentagon at the anthropomorphic wooden crash dummy explanation back in May of 1997, when pressed for, you know, an explanation as to why something, you know, that ridiculous. I mean, there was laughter throughout the press room at that time. And the Pentagon spokesperson responded, well, I guess, you know, when he was asked, do they expect the people to believe this? The press, you know, finally stood up and, you know, just as we would acknowledge that this is becoming, you know, just absolutely asinine. And the spokesperson said, well, then I guess we'll be here again in a few years offering another explanation. See, George, it's simply a case of them attempting to run out the clock, stall for time.
You co-wrote this book, Witness to Roswell, with Thomas Carey, and it's an excellent book. And you would think, as thorough as it is, that it would be the last word on the case. And yet now you have this new updated version with additional evidence. Paint for me in broad strokes the types of evidence, the quality of evidence that's come forward just in the last year or so.
Well, certainly the growing number of deathbed testimonies. Deathbeds, as you know, admissible in a court of law. And sadly, as we are running out of time, fortunately for the investigation, we are coming up with more and more such testimony. And invariably, they're all talking about the bodies. They're talking about the little people, the little men. something that obviously has haunted and weighed on these people for the rest of their lives. You know, concerning against something, you know, explained away as nothing more than a weather balloon.
Well, let's jump right into it. Deathbed confessions. Give me some examples.
Well, since even the book came out, we've talked to the widow of Robert L. Kopp. He was a master sergeant with the 393rd Bomb Squadron, which was headquartered at Roswell in 1947. And he had a top security clearance for anywhere on the base at that time. And when I say anywhere on the base, we're talking about the headquarters of the 509th Atomic Bomb Squadron, the first atomic bomb strike force in the world at that time. This was a squadron which had dropped the two atomic bombs on Japan just 2 years before. So this unit was the elite within the military at that time. They were the best pilots, the best officers, the best crewmen, the best doctors, best nurses, all in charge of the atomic bomb. So Kopp had a top security clearance for anywhere on that base, including the bomb sites. And yet at the time of the incident, the big hangar, as they always refer to it, was P3 at that time, Building 84. It's still there, and he would have, you know, just normally gone about his duties because the 393rd worked out of that B-29 hangar. So when he would report to duty that very next morning, he was told, first of all, don't even get close. And then he noticed that there was an encirclement around the hangar of armed MPs, armed guards. Something had happened, something big, something way beyond a plane crash or even an atomic accident for that matter, because that would have been something that the whole base would have been on, you know, on lockdown for the time. But he was specifically told, stay away from the hangar or you will be shot. And that's what he told his wife before he died.
Now, how did you acquire this information? Did the wife give it to you after he died?
Yes, well, we were referred to her by a colleague of his, one William Ennis, who was also a flight mechanic on the line at that time. And one of the interesting things that when Kevin Randall and I first talked to Ennis, now some 15, 16 years ago, he would just laugh it off. It was just a weather balloon, nothing to it. And within the last year now, he has finally acknowledged it was a spaceship. And he looked me right in the eyes and he said, Don, before I die, I want you to find out how that thing flew. It didn't have a moving part on it. And then Ennis was the one who referred us to a cop's widow who gave us a testimony about, the use of lethal force for anyone getting near a B-29 hangar.
We're going to take a break now. When we come back, perhaps the most important sort of a deathbed confession comes from Walter Hout, who was always been a key player in the Roswell story. We'll get into that with Don Schmidt right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. We're talking with Don Schmidt, co-author of the book Witness to Roswell. Don, you were talking before the break about deathbed confessions. Any other ones before we get to Walter Hout that you need to mention?
Well, another one, and again, regarding the very same hangar, which we've even had widows describe to us their husbands who were posted as guards, who were ordered basically report the P-3 hangar. They were handed a rifle and essentially told, you know, just stand your guard here, soldier. Don't look behind you or don't turn from this point. And if they would have an opportunity, more times than not, they would catch a glimpse of not only wreckage, but even the ship. And on occasion, the bodies laid out on the floor under a canvas tarp. And we describe in a whole chapter in the book on witness a deathbed testimony, such experiences. And now even beyond the book, we spoke to, he's still alive, a master sergeant by the name of Edward M. Farkas. He was with the 1st Air Transport Unit, and he was on the flight line on as far as at that particular hangar at the time when he observed the whole convoy of trucks and jeeps approaching, and quickly, wheel into the hangar, and no faster than they went into the building. The main doors were closed, and he was then told by one of the truckers after he had left the building that they had just brought in some of the actual wreckage, not of a weather balloon, but specifically the flying saucer from the crash site just north of town. Now, it's no different, George, than whenever, we're on the lecture circuit and we demonstrate that we've to date talked to over 600 people directly or indirectly involved, and we've yet to talk to a single source who describes any type of a weather balloon or hearing of any talk of a weather balloon or wooden crash dummies or anything else conventional, plane, rocket, even, secret experiment gone awry. They all talk about the buzz, the talk, the rumor throughout the town, beyond the base, the crash of the flying saucer, the wreckage of the flying saucer.
How much of your difficulty in piecing this thing together over the years is because just the nature of that generation, that the men who were in the 509th took an oath and decided to honor it, and they wouldn't even talk about it even on their deathbeds?
Extreme frustration. The reluctant witnesses who, for that very reason, as you described, the last great generation, that their word was their bond. They took an oath to the Constitution. They went on as good soldiers, whether pension was at stake or not. And sadly, most took the entire story to their grave. And that's the finality in all this, and all the more reason that we were actually quite astonished, and yet we weren't, when the Secretary of the Air Force, Sheila Windall, with the Project Mogul report in September of 1994, actually drafted a release of their security oaths that they were now free to talk about this. Now, we kind of laughed at it at the time because the press didn't pick up on it. But it was a security oath release for the Air Force. Well, there was no Air Force in July of 1947.
That's right.
This was an Army incident. And the idea, and as we would pose this very, picadillo to, former or retired Army, they would laugh and say, hell of the Air Force is going to give us, release on a security oath. But yet, it's worked to our advantage in the sense that we've been able to demonstrate it, show it, and for those who switched over to Air Force, they would scratch their heads, and I would honestly say 25% of the time, it's enabled them to talk. And it was an example that we give, for example, with Sergeant Earl Fulford, who was actually part of the recovery team. They did the follow-up recovery at the debris field site where the object had the mid-air explosion and then rained debris that covered this huge area that the head of intelligence, Major Jesse Marcel, and the head of counterintelligence, Captain Sheridan Cabot, would first go to as led by the very rancher who would discover that site, Mac Brazel. And Fulford described to us that there was still debris. They were assigned to pick up the remaining artifacts. And he described to us that as he would pick up pieces, and they were flexible, they would crumble in his hand, he would toss them into his sack hanging over his shoulder, and he would feel them snap. He would feel them open up as though they were literally, returning to their original shape and size, as he tossed piece after piece into the sack. Now, we had the good fortune 2 years ago, just before he died, taking Fulford actually to the site. And we had him walk about and describe and demonstrate what he recalled, what he remembered from, at that time, 61 years ago. So it's exciting in that sense when we're able to take people back and actually recreate what has happened. As you know, certainly as a newsman, George, that more times than not, the press likes to just deal with a talking head. We'll just sit you down here at this chair and tell us what you remember. But whenever we've been able, we have taken people, we have brought people back to Roswell, out to the sites, out to the base, out to the big hangar, and had them describe exactly what they remembered. And it's also been helpful to them to be there. Many of them haven't been there in over 50 years. And it brings back a rush of memories and faces, and they've been also able to provide us with new leads. But unfortunately, even these new leads won't talk. They took an oath. I think the best example that we've ever talked about was the Provost Marshal, Edwin Easley, who would go on, he would retire as Lieutenant Colonel. He was in charge of all security at the recovery sites, at the base. And when we found him back in 1990, and the first words out of his mouth were, "I can't talk about it. I am still sworn to secrecy." And no matter what angle, no matter how he was asked about being there, were you at the site? Did you see anything? Were you even privy to any information regarding the incident? "Can't talk about it. I'm sworn to secrecy." It didn't matter. After all those years, he, in his mind, was still sworn to secrecy. And then after our first book came out, UFO Crash at Roswell, Kevin Rando and I did a year later, and he was sent a copy, and he was called and asked, "Can you at least tell us if we're going in the right direction?" To which he responded, "Well, let's just say you're not going in the wrong direction."
Of course, anybody who knows the Roswell story fairly well knows Walter Hout. I even got a chance to interview him back in the late 80s. He's been interviewed by everyone basically who's done this story. He was the press officer who issued the press release under orders from his commander that says we recovered a flying saucer, and he's always been a central player in the mystery. And but his role in it took a different turn here after he died. It's sort of a deathbed confession, a statement that came out released after his death. Tell me about that.
Well, as close as we were to Walter, and I'm glad you, George, qualified it that he put out the press release under orders of his base commander, Colonel William Blanchard. And Walter and Blanchard were extremely close. Walter would describe it as a uncle-nephew relationship. And in fact, Walter would have, if he would have followed in Butch, as he was called, footsteps, he would have clearly gone on to become a general himself. And, in fact, when Blanchard died in 1966, Walter, at his desk in Washington, at the Pentagon, Walter wasn't just called. He didn't just receive a letter or read about it in the papers. They sent a special courier from Washington who went directly to his home in Roswell to inform him of the general's passing. That's pretty close. That's family. And so we always suspected that Walter had to be, you know, more involved than he ever described.
And but he never let on.
He never, but to us, he slowly did. And that was one of the reasons and one of the ways we were able to compile all the information that became part of his sealed statement. I remember the one time we were sitting in Walter's office at the museum in Roswell, and we were just, you know, just talking politics or even the weather for that matter. And all at once, I just, you know, just blurted out, "Walter, how tall did Blanchard tell you the bodies were?" And his arm immediately shot out from his chair to about, you know, just over his head, you know, suggesting about 3.5-4 feet tall.
Hang on.
Had him going.
Hang on, Don Schmidt, because I want you to tell our audience about some threats that were made to Walter, to Walter's life, right up until the end. Stay with us. We're talking about the Roswell case here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Don Schmidt, co-author of Witness to Roswell. Is it possible there is still new evidence to surface in this case? He says yes. In particular, he says that threats were made against people like Walter Hout and others, that hitmen were sent to Roswell to enforce those threats. We'll get into those stories right after this. Stay with us. Our guest is Don Smith, co-author of Witness to Roswell. We're talking about Walter Haut, the press officer for the 509th, the guy who put out the press release saying that they'd found a flying saucer. Don, you hinted before the break that Walter was feeding you little tidbits to pique your curiosity. How is it that he wrote this final statement to be released after his death? Did someone talk him into it, and was that you?
Actually, it was. And as I had originally described, it was through the years and all the time that we had known Walter, we had attempted everything from hypnosis to even, you know, signing a statement in front of a state official, meeting with state politicians, being afforded an opportunity to speak behind closed doors, and Walter never budged. He never gave in to anything of that nature. And it was an idea that was spawned by the late Captain Sheridan Cavett, who also retired a lieutenant colonel. He was head of counterintelligence at Roswell, a name that has become synonymous with the cover-up itself. And his son Joe is an attorney. And before Cavett had passed away, his son was attempting the legal act of signing a sealed statement. In other words, Dad, you know, at least put something down for posthumous release. And all his father would say was, I'm not ready. I'm still not ready. Well, unfortunately, he never was ready. He ran out of time. We ran out of time. But the idea stuck. It was something that we then suggested to Walter Haut. And it took a little more insistence on our part, but as I was describing, he was already admitting certain things behind closed doors. He was acknowledging that there were cleanup teams going out for years after the incident. He acknowledged that there was a temporary morgue set up at the base hospital. Well, why would you need a temporary morgue? Unless, again, some disasters, some fatalities, you know, were involved with some incident. And he started hinting more and more about the body. Well, we finally put it all down for his perusal, for his final acceptance, and in the presence of his daughter, Julie, and another witness, as well as a notary, he went over it three separate times. And as his daughter, Julie, would demonstrate that if there was a single word Walter would not have agreed with, he would not have signed that statement.
And give me the thumbnail sketch. What did the statement say? What did he say in it? Basically confirmed the story you're outlining.
That he had not only been out to the crash site, that he had handled pieces of the actual wreckage, that he brought pieces back to his very public information office, which were displayed to others in that office, that Blanchard himself took him over to, I keep referring to the big hangar, that P3, Building 84, which became the repository, the storage site for everything before it was shipped out. He was given a first-hand opportunity to see what all the, you know, big alarm was all about. And he saw the ship. He saw what was he described as a Volkswagen-sized pod, an egg-shaped object inside the hangar, as well as other wreckage. But then he saw what he at first thought were children, because they were the size of children. And then he quickly saw that, as he had heard, that they were not. The heads were disproportionately larger, and that it was something else. And I think it's one of the reasons that he became the official ambassador at Roswell in the founding of the museum. And, you know, honoring his oath of secrecy, but more so for the fact that he was also threatened.
Well, we'll get into that in a second. I wanted to get back into this Roswell tourism thing, though, before we leave this subject. You know, people could say, well, look, this is Walter Haut's final gift to the town of Roswell to make sure that the story stays alive and the town continues to prosper.
Well, the town had prospered quite well as long as the base still was in operation up until the late 60s. And true, that could have been... It was the same thing that was postulated by Phil Jones of CBS 48 Hours, that wasn't it possible that a bunch of them sat around and concocted this whole story for the benefit of the tourism trade, create a museum and make this into, you know, this shining star of visitation down in the Southwest. And the problem is, well, they waited till almost everybody was gone. They waited till everybody was passed on to really benefit from it. And as you described, yeah, it could have been one's legacy. It could have been one's final gift. But that wasn't Walter's nature. I knew him personally for 20 years. And even in the creation of the museum, it wasn't something that came easy. It wasn't something that just was, you know, an epiphany in his mind one night. It was something that we jointly encouraged the city fathers to do, because after the success of our first book and the second, and then the Roswell motion picture, which was based on our first book, we became very concerned that the outside opportunists would come in and commercialize the entire event. So Walter's concern was for the historic preservation of the incident. Now, this was already back in 1991. He could have quickly gone public. He could have used his information to really launch the facility. And yet it wasn't until after he passed away. In fact, it was 2 years after he died that the statement finally was released.
You hinted in your notes to me that there were threats. I know you've said that there were threats made to a lot of people, but there were threats made to Walter Hutt?
Absolutely. In fact, he and his wife described the very same experiences, that they would come at all hours of the night, and specifically from two people. One he called the Norseman from Canada, who basically would tell him to keep his mouth shut, that it never happened. And the other he called the Shadow, who would call up at 2, 3 o'clock in the morning and yell into the phone, "Halt! You better keep your mouth shut, or you know what'll happen."
Do you know who these people are?
No, have no idea, and Walter didn't either. Just that they also, or at least one of them, would claim that he would also periodically visit Roswell and even keep an eye on things. I think more specifically, there was a counterintelligence officer who worked under, who was with General Roger Ramey, who was Blanchard's boss, head of the 8th Air Force at Carswell Army Airfield in, outside of Dallas, Texas. And Knight knew Halt already, Walter already, from Saipan and Kauai and operation as far as Crossroads prior to that. What was interesting is that Knight used to pay Walter a visit after the incident and always show him pictures of lenticular clouds and airborne balloons and that type of thing, and see, Walter, how it can all be easily explained. Nothing to it. So they realized that they had the possibility of a loose cannon with Walter, a whistleblower. And I think between the threatening phone calls and Milton Knight, who Walter even showed us, displayed us a Christmas card that Knight sent him. And what was interesting is that they stopped right after we started our own investigation of Roswell. Up to that time, he had been receiving Christmas cards. And in the final card, a handwritten note, "I still say there were no bodies at Fort Worth." Well, and in Walter's mind, he was clearly referencing Roswell, clearly referencing the 1947 incident. And so Knight was still conducting damage control, and that was in 1989, 40 years after the incident.
All these threats that were made to people like Walter and others that you've mentioned in your book, was any of them ever carried out? I know you hinted that there was a hitman that was dispatched to Roswell.
Well, there was a Colonel Hunter Penn. He was with the Air Force, and he would tell his family, and we talked to his son and daughter, and he would describe that he had undertaken a deadly, serious assignment back in 1947. He was sent out from Wright Field, or Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, and he was sent to Roswell. And putting it euphemistically, His job was to help manage the civilian military affairs after the crash. Well, manage, you know, the civilian military situation. This was, again, within, you know, a year after the incident. And he was basically assigned to ensure that there was, they remained a blackout, an information blackout over the incident.
Was there any?
But he was to concentrate specifically on the civilians, the ranchers, you know, members of the press and so on, who specifically were aware of the bodies, who had knowledge of the bodies. And he was instructed to even use physical force if necessary.
But did he? I mean, we've heard these stories about threats of violence and we'll kill your family, but did any violence ever take place? Anybody roughed up? Anybody disappear?
To this point, George, it all appears to have been verbal. But back then, when they threatened to kill your children, I'm sure that's all it took. Now, we did have an officer years ago who suggested we should check out all the accidents around Roswell shortly thereafter the incident. And he kind of, you know, smugly grinned at us and suggested they weren't all accidents. Now, we're looking into a number of things, including a number of even suicides shortly after the incident. In fact, there was a suicide on the west side of the base within weeks after the incident. It's always hard, and that's where the ultimate, you talk about cold case to determine foul play, to actually have people who had the ultimate acts of oppression and silencing take place in their lives. But I think the most significant example might have been the Brazzo family itself. And Mac Brazzo himself would die in 1963, and yet his grandson was out hunting with two individuals, and his grandson and a partner were both shot to death during this hunting excursion. And according to the state police report, both were accidentally shot by two separate shots.
That's a heck of an accident.
That's a heck of an accident. That's a heck of an accident.
One of the other things that you've dug up, new information, new testimony, or deals with a guy from Life, a photojournalist from Life. Who was that?
That was Alan Grant. In fact, Alan Grant was basically told, you know, get on your plane and get down to New Mexico. There had been a meteor crash. You know, we want to get a picture of the bolide. Get a picture, you know, get a first in that regard. And what was interesting with Grant was that when he arrived in Albuquerque, he was assigned a holster gun, a pistol, and was told that just in case. Well, he found that to be rather unusual. I mean, why would I need a gun, you know, for checking out a meteorite? And he arrived down in Roswell, and then he was told nothing to it. It was just all explained away, no reason to go out there. And we believe that they brought in Life magazine because even Walter Hoth described that he had a stack of press calls, contacts from the media, about 6 inches tall, 6 inches high on his desk. And what better way to shut down the national media than to bring in Life magazine, have them come all the way down to New Mexico, and then just tell them, false alarm, nothing to it. And Grant, for the rest of his life, you know, just assumed that was the very case, nothing to it. But then as he looked into it more and more, as he, again, another deathbed testimony on his part, explained to his wife that he became convinced that he was used as a diversion, that he was used for that very purpose, to take, you know, to further distract and detour the press away from looking into this any further. And it worked. Life magazine said nothing to it. Why would anybody else bother?
There, of course, is the famous photo of the little news conference in the office there where Jesse Marcel is shown with some wreckage from a balloon, and there's a cable, some sort of a cable that somebody in the photo is holding. And because of image technology is so much better, you guys are able to basically read what's on that cable. That is an astonishing new development in this case, I think. Tell us what was on the cable.
Well, you mentioned the press conference at Fort Worth. And interesting that all attention is shifted away from Roswell. It's all sent up the chain of command. I mean, we talked about General Ramey a few moments ago being Colonel Blanchard's boss. And the afternoon of July 8th, within hours after the press release that Walter Hott typed up and hand-delivered to the two local radio stations and two newspapers, and Ramey ordered Marcel to bring some of the actual material directly to his attention in Fort Worth. And that was another piece of information from Walter Hott, because he described how after Marcel would return from Fort Worth, that Marcel was especially angry about the fact that he had actually placed a box of the real material, the actual stuff, on Ramey's desk. And Ramey took him to a map room, and upon returning back to his office, the real stuff was gone, and in its place, scattered on the floor in front of his desk, was this weather balloon with a radar reflector kite. And people are of the impression that there was a full room of reporters. Well, that wasn't the case. The reporters were kept out of the room, and only a single photographer by the name of James Bond Johnson in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram was allowed into the office. And that's when Marcel was ordered by Ramey to pose for those two famous pictures, clearly holding up a section of the kite, the radar reflector kite. Well, in three of the subsequent pictures of General Ramey, he's holding a piece of paper. And in two of the shots, it's the back of the paper. Nothing, no verbiage, no words are visible. But in one of the shots, it's folded over and is a paragraph. There's a whole series of lines of text that are visible. And I guess I could take the credit back in 1990 when we already were able to acquire prints, copies from the original negatives that were preserved down in Texas. And I kept thinking to myself, they're right on the edge. If we were able to computer enhance these, who knows what might be there. And at the time, we merely suspected that it was a press release regarding the weather balloon explanation. So we sent a enlarged print of that telex to Dr. Richard Haynes. And Dr. Haynes was able to come out with a few letters here and there, but specifically the word balloon. So it just solidified our impression that it was strictly a press release about the weather balloon explanation. But as the years went by and as computer programs, as you describe, became, more useful tools in discerning and doing photo interpretation. Specifically, Dr. David Rudiak, who works with us, as you know, George, mm-hmm. I feel has done the most definitive, most decisive interpretation of what now appears to be an actual telex that was sent to General Hoyt Vandenberg in Washington regarding the incident, and describing two specific sites, the word disc, and most specifically, victims of the wreck. Victims.
Don, we need to take a break. I want to open up the phone lines when we come back, but I also want to ask you about this new information about a metal sample that was analyzed in the year after the Roswell crash. And the amazing new information that surfaced on that. Stay with us, everyone, on Coast to Coast.